VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game podcast from The Times. And if you're thinking that doesn't sound like Gab Marcotti, that's because he's swanning around America, I think watching some team called the Eagles in a sport I'm not familiar with. But we're going to talk about something far more important, English football, while Gab watches a bit of NFL or whatever it is. I'm Matt Dickinson, Chief Sports Writer of The Times, and I'm joined by two of my finest colleagues. Sitting opposite me is Bill Edgar, our football writer and stats guru, as you'll all know. And down the phone line from somewhere in Yorkshire, Lancashire, north somewhere, is Ollie Kay, our chief football correspondent. But don't worry, this is 1 week only. I'm going to be sitting in this chair. Gab will be back next week with his usual unique enthusiasm. And you actually do get a fix of him on this show. He sat down with Raphael Honigstein to discuss his fine new book, Klopp, Bring the Noise. So that's coming up, but only after we have looked back at the Premier League weekend. And we're going to start actually with Southampton Everton. I know probably going into the weekend, Liverpool Chelsea seemed the biggest game, but results have proved otherwise. And I think we're going to start on the blue side of Merseyside. And well, I think shambles is probably the word for Everton at the moment. Ollie, wouldn't you agree?
I think there are various words, none of them complimentary. And in fact, a word like shambles might in fact be slightly flattering to them at the moment. They just look awful, dreadful, horrific. I think there was a lot of overexcitement when they spent all that money in the summer. And then, of course, they lost Lukaku and they didn't replace him. And I think some people were, and not me, were expecting too much of them, given that there was an imbalance in the squad. But despite that imbalance in the squad, and despite various teething issues that you'd probably expect, you would expect so much more of so many of those players. And what they look like is either that they just look crushed confidence-wise, or that there's just no spirit or no desire among those players. It's just terrible, one game after the next. And you can't say it's all the same players, because there were such wholesale changes between the lineups from Atalanta on Thursday to Southampton on Sunday, and the same outcome. And you know, obviously we can talk about David Unsworth as well, and him being found to be sort of totally out of his depth. But I just really feel sorry for him, because you know that he is giving his best, and I don't really think you can look at every Everton player and say that the same applies at the moment.
I think there's no doubt that there's many different ways that Everton are going wrong at the moment. But surely this is something that can be, Bill, just fixed with a good manager. You know, this is a decent squad. I mean, this is a top 10 squad, surely. So is it that simple?
It would. I think it can make a big change. I mean, you look at players they brought in the summer, and certainly one or two have proved not up to it at all. But the likes of Michael Keane and Gylfi Sigurdsson, I mean, they're real class players, but they're being dragged down by this general malaise. I mean, the whole team seems demoralised. A lot of the problem yesterday against Southampton was that the midfield runners of Southampton weren't being tracked, so that's how many of the goals came. So it's just a kind of a lack of teamwork, a lack of... It's just feeling as if everything's collapsing around them. One problem they've had is at fullback, which hasn't been mentioned too much, and 3 or 4 years ago, Leighton Baines, I thought, was a title-winning standard player. He could easily have... he was linked with Manchester United. I thought he might well go there, replace Patrice Evra and be at United, you know, for 5 or 6 years or something. But he stayed at Everton and he's really gone downhill a lot, but he's not been replaced at all. And then on the other side, there's Seamus Coleman, who got injured towards the end of last season playing for Ireland, and now he's out till, I think, till at least mid January, and he's just not been replaced at all. They've tried two or three different players, they've different systems, right wing back and right back. They've got to get a new manager in. It's 5 weeks now since they sacked Ronald Koeman. I mean, this must be approaching some sort of record. You know, now and again, clubs take a long time to replace their permanent manager, but usually by this stage, they've said to the caretaker manager, right, you're here till the end of the season, or till, you know, given them a definite time span. As it is, there's just uncertainty has gone on and on and on, which is not helping at all.
I did my column on Mr. Mashiri on last Friday morning, and I can't imagine he was thrilled if he's read it. Ollie, can we have any trust in him to bring in the right guy? And who is that right guy? The two O'Neills have been mentioned. Obviously, they tried for Marco Silva to the point where they got a cease and desist letter from Watford last week. Who do you think they'll go to? Who should they go to?
Well, when Koeman was sacked it was October, wasn't it? Or
yeah, about 35 days, yeah. I think we're talking.
It was at that point, 9 games were gone, and yes, I think they were in the bottom 3 at the time. But it didn't look, you know, when people say, oh, they need a Sam Allardyce, they need a Tony Pulis, they need somebody to just keep them up. That looked a really sort of extreme suggestion at the time, because you thought, well, no, they just need somebody who's going to go in and pick them up and take them forwards. But now, you know, 5 Premier League games later, and of course the Europa League games, which have probably brought even more pain and anguish and humiliation, it does look like a situation where they do need a firefighter, and they're not going to get Marco Silva now. If Marco Silva's the guy that they are desperate to get, and if they think they will get him, which I don't think is certain at all. But if that's the case, then they do need to look at an interim type. And an interim type, you know, it could mean a Hiddink or somebody like that, or more likely it could mean an Allardyce type or a Pulis type or an O'Neill type. And I can understand why none of those options would appeal to Evertonians, because, you know, I think they went into this season thinking, well, we're now the newest member of the elite, and it's quite a come down to be thinking, oh, we're going to appoint one of those sort of firefighting managers that Crystal Palace and West Brom and clubs like that appoint. But it does look desperate enough to think that, well, what they actually need is somebody who's going to just go in and keep them up.
Which is a long way from Mashiri's quote about, you know, this is now the Hollywood of football, the Northwest. You know, we got Guardiola, we got Mourinho, we got Klopp, and he was talking about Everton being, you know, having a superstar manager to compete on that level, but they simply can't get a superstar manager at this time of the year.
No.
Can?
No, I don't think so. No, one manager might be worth considering who's not been talked about, and I think Ollie touched on it in a column, was Eddie Howe at Bournemouth. He started badly this season, and so when the early clubs were sacking their manager, he wasn't mentioned because people thought, oh, maybe he'd been found out or something. But sure enough, they've recovered and they're doing really well. I mean, when I look at what he's done on paper, you could argue he's the greatest manager in English football history, taking Bournemouth from the bottom of the fourth tier up to mid-table in the Premier League. I mean, done it twice, and now he's there again in mid-table. And also, the type of football he plays is perfectly expansive. So if they're really pushing to be a Champions League club, well, they're not thinking about going to Sam Allardyce and playing the long ball or something. Well, Eddie Howe, on the face of it, would fit that idea.
Ollie, does that get your vote?
As Bill said, I mentioned that in October when everybody was saying, oh, well, it's got to be Dyche, it's got to be so-and-so. And Eddie Howe just wasn't mentioned at all because Bournemouth happened to have made a slow start to the season, which I thought was just depressing that people would suddenly forget about Eddie Howe's previous 8 years because they've had a difficult 8 weeks. But that probably says a lot about English football. But if you looked at next summer, or indeed the summer just gone, I think someone like Eddie Howe would have been perfect for Everton. I think somewhere like Everton would be perfect for Eddie Howe. But in November, or late November, early December, when it's a relegation fight, when you're not going in with a pre-season to get your ideas across, and they're that kind of, you know, he's that kind of manager. Sean Dyche, in a very different kind of way, is that kind of manager, a sort of builder. A lot of the younger managers want to sort of build. They don't want to go in and mid-season and without a pre-season and be left to firefight. So I don't see that, even if, I mean, he's actually an Everton fan, Eddie Howe, but even if they went for him really hard, or went for Marco Silva or went for Sean Dyche, I don't really see that it's the appealing job that it would have been even 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Would they end up with a cease and desist letter from Bournemouth as well? But that's, I suspect, no doubt we'll find out the appointment with Mr. Mashiri's rather strange communication methods. We'll no doubt find out via his our friends at TalkSport, randomly announced. Seems to be, that's certainly how Unsworth found out that he wasn't going to be the new manager, which, say, takes us back to the word shambles. But I guess we shouldn't, we'll get complaints from Southampton if we don't actually mention them. They did stroll out 4-1 winners. And as someone who's got QPR season tickets, every time Charlie Austin scores, it pains me to the core. But he's just a quality finisher. I guess his job's made easier when no one actually marks you or challenges you for headers, Bill. But that was sort of Charlie Austin to a T.
It was, yeah. And Southampton haven't looked such a disorganised team as people have made out this season. Obviously, they've had a great problem scoring, but you look at the table and they're now in the top half, albeit among just at the top of a cluster of teams close together on points. But they haven't looked too far off this season. It's just been the finishing. And of course, that's where Austin comes in. He's a very good finisher. Shane Long is a good all-round player, but again, he missed a decent chance yesterday. His finishing record isn't as good as Austin, so maybe Austin is the final piece in the jigsaw to keep Southampton in their natural habitat of comfortable mid-table.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from Austin or otherwise and every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League and the FA Cup. And it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. So sign up. Talking of goals, Ollie, your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League?
We were talking about it beforehand, and I mentioned one which, unfortunately, Bill had beaten me to, so I won't name that one. I think my favourite in the circumstances would be Gylfi Sigurdsson's probably rare flash of brilliance this season. That shot for the Everton goal at St Mary's was fantastic. I just loved, from an aesthetic point of view, the way it went in, sort of crossbar, post, crossbar. You know, it was beautiful and all too rare illustration of his talent this season.
That's because he's stuck on the blinking wing, isn't it? Most of the time, I've seen them. I mean, he has to be a centralish player, doesn't he? And anyway, we're back on the Everton shambles. But the consolation is he has got Ollie's goal of the weekend. So
only because Bill beat me to the other one.
Well, and talking of which, Bill, fire away.
That other one is the goal by Xherdan Shaqiri for Stoke at Crystal Palace. Most of his goals tend to be pretty amazing, and this was no exception. He picked up the ball just inside the Crystal Palace half and it just showed great balance to sway this way and that. There were various players, Milivojevic and Schlupp were close by, but he kind of evaded them, and then Sacco came and there's a nice kind of body swerve to get beyond Sacco, and then obviously a decent finish at the end to put Stoke ahead. Unfortunately for him, Palace came back to win, but it's a good memory nonetheless.
Both chosen losing goals. We've got no time for losers on this show. They should have been banned. Huddersfield 1, Manchester City 2. And well, Ollie, we've sort of all looking forward, or have been looking forward, to the Manchester derby. As you know, this was going to be sort of the Classico brought back to Manchester, Guardiola, Mourinho competing for a title. Actually, is it now over as a title contest and just a bit of theatre?
The gap is 8 points, and you could say it's 9 points because of City's enormous goal difference, and that's enormous by this time of the season. But if United were to win that, it would look a bit healthier from their point of view, that City are picking up one or two injury problems. They've got that difficult Christmas period to get through, and Guardiola hasn't really come through, emerged successfully through the a Premier League winter yet. He found it very tough last year. But if this sounds like I'm convinced that Man United are going to make a game of it, I'm not really. I think Man City are on another level. I just feel that is the chance for United. That game on a week on Sunday is the chance for them to pull them back, and I'm sure, as demeaning as Mourinho might find this, I'm sure he would have found himself impressed and perhaps inspired by some of what David Wagner did yesterday, because I thought Huddersfield made it about as difficult for City as anybody has done over the last few months. I mean, there was that draw against Everton early on. But Huddersfield seemed to get it right in terms of denying them spaces, in terms of getting the wingers back, and it was almost like an 8-1-1 at times, the way they were playing, but it worked. It wasn't just sit deep and sit tight and cling on for dear life. It was a well thought out plan and a well executed plan that came very close to getting a result. So,
but bearing in mind this is Jose we're talking about, I mean, they're going to try and kick the crap out of them, aren't they, Bill? I mean, that's, you know, they're not going to match them. You know, even Man United, with the most expensive player in the country and all the ability they have, they're just going to have to try and get blinking physical and stick a finger in the eye, literally or metaphorically, aren't they?
Yeah, or kick somebody in the groin like Lukaku at the weekend. The table says 8 points, and it doesn't lie at all. There's a huge gap between the clubs at the moment. Just looking through Manchester City's games, I think they've deserved to win every game comfortably. They've been so good this season. Even when, as you say, it was a different challenge yesterday facing Huddersfield, but they came through it. They didn't panic at all. They just carried on and on and on, and they absolutely deserved the victory, albeit with a fairly streaky late goal. But yeah, you can't see Manchester United being anything other than scrapping against City, really sitting back. I mean, even against Brighton at the weekend, United were so disappointing. For if you're looking for an entertaining game, it was so cautious. I mean, on paper, that's pretty much the easiest game of the whole season, you know, at home to a newly promoted team. Brighton player for player, obviously United are far more talented, but they were just sat back. There was just no pace, and this is Mourinho's style. I mean, I'm not saying it's necessarily the worst style in terms of achieving success.
Well, how do you think he'll approach it, Ollie?
I think we'll see Fellaini, and I think the presence of Fellaini, whether as a sort of false 10 or as a sort of just nuisance in midfield, I think that will define United's approach. It means that they'll go direct. I think it means that they'll be wanting to make it all about, you know, winning the first ball, winning the second ball,
and sticking an elbow out.
Certainly elbows out. And it sounds rather sad when you're Manchester United for a start, but when you've spent, I don't know, whatever it's been, 500 million or something over the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, they spent fortunes on creative players, and yet they are not even close to, you know, from a creative point of view, from an aesthetic point of view, and from a stylish point of view, to what City are doing. And if this sounds all very unfair on United, it's only really by comparison with what City are doing. United are the best of the rest, and have been reasonable this season, if a little bit disappointing over the last sort of 6 weeks or so, but City just do look on another level, and they look like a group of players, and particularly the attacking creative players, who just are loving playing for their manager. Whereas United, you know, no matter which players he plays in the front four, he seems to be angry with at least two or three of them, and it's, that is a pattern that we've seen before with Mourinho, and you think, well, if your flair players, if your sort of attacking players are never ever living up to your standards, or, you know, even if it's Eden Hazard, even if it's Oscar at Chelsea, Fabregas, whoever, Martial, Rashford, Fellaini, Mata, maybe the approach is the problem. It's an approach that has won a lot of trophies, but it's an approach that seems inferior, in my opinion, to what Guardiola is doing at City.
Bill, you're our stats man, not necessarily our gambling man, but I mean, City got 25 games left. Chances of them going unbeaten?
Can you give us
some odds?
I'd say about one chance in four, perhaps, of doing that. They're looking good. I mean, the front six, they've got a very settled team. I mean, they've got obviously some decent backup players, but they've got a very settled team. So they know how they're playing. They've got the Fernandinho defensive midfield, then Silva and De Bruyne just ahead of him, and then three ahead, and that's three from four with Sterling, Sane, Aguero and Jesus. So they really they're developing a good understanding amongst themselves, and obviously Sterling has come on a lot this season, I think, and he's finishing better, so that's good news for England. I mean, he was one of the culprits at Euro 2016 when England created a lot of chances in the group matches and scored with very few of them. He's been improved by Guardiola. He's finishing better. That's good, a good sign for the summer.
Ollie, is a good point. I mean, but Southgate's changed his system now. Does Sterling fit in? I mean, if you're playing wing backs, if you're playing a 3-5-2. That Southgate was using, where does Sterling fit into that?
Well, I was surprised that it was 3-5-2 in the last match. I would have thought the best way forward is to have somebody like Sterling or somebody like Ali or maybe both of them playing off Kane, not necessarily wide, but 3-4-2-1 or something rather than the 3-5-2. I would think there would be scope for Sterling to play in that. Definitely. I mean, he hasn't really played well for England, and I don't think that's unfair to suggest that. But it makes you think it's more about England than about him, because his talent is clear. And on the question about will City go unbeaten, I would be very, very surprised if they go unbeaten, just because they're pleasingly they are a team who take a lot of risks. They're not going to. They will never play for a draw. They will. They will never go into the last 10 minutes of the game and think, oh well, look, we'll just take what we've got here. That they will always go and try to win, and try to win big. And when you do that, you do take certain risks that make it likely that you'll concede at the back sooner or later. I think one record that they will break, undoubtedly, in my opinion, is the number of Premier League goals in a season. I think the record is 103 held by Chelsea in the Premier League era. City are currently on course for 122 or 123, I think they just will break that record, and they could well break the points record too. I think they look that good.
Well, if you do want to put a tenner on City to go unbeaten, Bill Edgar is offering, 4-1? So
3-1 if there's one chance.
That's why he's the stats guy and I'm not. But anyway, send your tenners in, and we'll see you at the end of the year. But we should. I don't want to pass this weekend without talking about the Rainbow Laces campaign. And I guess, that word laces, maybe we should start with, because it did seem to me. I'm struggling to think of a player who actually wore the laces. We certainly saw armbands, captain's armbands. We saw, plenty of sort of signalling of it. Great. I mean, I think it's an important part of the debate. Our colleague Alex Kajelski wrote very well on it last week about why it matters and why it's important and what football can do to advance awareness and discussion about a subject like this. But Ollie, did you see the laces themselves? Does that matter, or is it just important that we're raising awareness and having this discussion at all?
Well, it was left to players to make their own minds up. I think a few at Tottenham certainly did. I'm told one or two at Crystal Palace did. But to me, the fact that it is called the Rainbow Laces campaign. I remember a couple of years ago when this was first introduced by Stonewall. It was, a very good initiative. They sent these rainbow laces to I think every player in the Premier League, and I think every player in the Football League, and I think a handful wore them. The referees did. Am I right in thinking that all the referees wore them? And am I right in thinking that a few of the managers wore them, and the captains wore them? Now, this to me suggests, and I haven't got this, don't know this as a fact, but this to me suggests that the initiative from Stonewall has been, right, can we get all your players to wear these? And it's been this kind of compromise of, we don't want to force people to do this. We don't want to force. Well, they pretty much force people to wear poppies. Is this less of a worthy cause? I think it's great in that there has been progress, great that the more awareness has been raised, but it does seem to me like that there's a resistance among players to wearing the laces. It just seems like a statement too far for them, and I think maybe if it was just introduced as something that Premier League clubs do and players do, that it's mandatory, Would any of them have a problem with that? I don't know.
Bill, what do you think it was pushed enough? Do you think that it's getting through to fans?
I think the fact that it was introduced at all is a very positive sign. You know, the Wembley arch, all sorts of logos everywhere. It was very visible, actually, on laces. It's hard to pick out, really. You know, you really have to pause your video and study a boot which happened to be very close up. So, I mean, it was very visible, which is a good sign. I think the Poppy comparison is very interesting. I think it's much better to not make it compulsory, because with the Poppies, once it's compulsory, it becomes meaningless. I mean, it shows that, say, an individual club supports the idea, but it doesn't show that the players support the idea individually.
And James McLean ends up getting ludicrous hate mail just for exercising his free expression.
I mean, it's a political statement. Perhaps everybody in the world thinks that's a good idea. That's absolutely fine, but you shouldn't really be forcing people to wear poppies anyway. You know, but in any case, as I say, it becomes meaningless because it's not a decision you've made. So I think the idea of letting players decide if they want to wear the laces is a good thing, but in general, that yes, football pushing this idea of inclusiveness is obviously good. Any sane person doesn't mind which partner people choose to have in their life.
Do you think it will actually affect Ollie, whether the moment when a player feels he is able to come out? I remember I did an interview with Thomas Hitzlsperger, obviously retired before he came out, but the debate often becomes about the fear factor, you know, fear of the reaction from either fans or teammates. But he actually made a very important point, I think, about becoming the champion, the sort of standard bearer. And he basically just, you know, the intensity of the focus around him when he came out, he said he wouldn't sort of wish that on a serving player who has to try and sort of keep his career on track while suddenly becoming the centre of this frenzy. Do you think this, you know, the Stonewall campaign is going to help reach the point when a player can feel free to talk about his sexuality?
I think it undoubtedly will help, but I agree with the point that Hitzlsperger made to you, that there would just be an enormous circus around it, not through the players being by any means, but there would be the media attention, the public attention. You know, it would be positive, it would be warm, it would be appreciative, and isn't this great? But it would just be, you know, the player would, I fear, for an amount of time, would come to be sort of defined by that. He would be gay footballer X, and I'm talking about media coverage, I'm talking about public reaction as well. I think it would be positive, but whether it's positive on somebody's career to have all of that attention on them, I don't know. I think I can well understand why a player would think, well, I'll just get on with my career. I'm not going to bring my private life into it. I can talk comfortably about that when I'm retired. But why bring it upon myself now? It's becoming that I think more than the fear of homophobic abuse in the dressing room, which I just don't think would happen. Homophobic abuse on the terraces, which probably would happen in a really small way. But I think it's that issue. I think it's the attention and the sort of intensity of that glare that would probably be the most persuasive argument against it at the moment.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
How
would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two
Tiny Women with Gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
We should now give you your fix of Gab. Raphael Honigstein has written an excellent book on Jurgen Klopp. So here is Gab talking to Raphael now.
Delighted to be joined by Raphael Honigstein. You can see him on BT Sport on Champions League nights, and you can hear him on various podcasts and read him in various places. But what you want to read him about is this book that you wrote, Raph, about Jurgen Klopp, imaginatively titled Bring the Noise. I want to get to something that I was struck by that I learned about. The fact that young Jurgen Klopp had, while he was a professional footballer, a bit of a striker sometimes and a defender, and this whole stuff with his dad. I thought, like, now in writing this, because this is not an official biography, you're not ghosting it, was he super forthcoming about all this stuff?
He wasn't at all forthcoming. He
immediately pried into his private life.
Yes. He immediately through his agent said, I'm not going to get involved in this book at all. I've had offers in the past. I've had people who I've known for Mainz for 30 years who said, let's do a book. And I've always said no, because I only want to do a book once I retire. You know, that was fair enough. But what he really did was help me with the research by way of just allowing everybody who I approached to talk to me. Because it would have been easy for him to say, don't talk to this guy. Because that was one of the most surprising things in the research. Former managers, former players, people who have no real contact with him anymore, people like Ilkay Gundogan, you know, at Man City, what do they care about Klopp necessarily? Almost to a man, they first said to me, I need to ask Klopp first. So he still exerts that kind of power on people. And
it's like he's Fergie or something. Yeah. What does he think he is?
It is a bit like that. And he told everybody, including his sister and the people, you know, that he grew up with, that, yeah, you can talk to this guy.
I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of a guy who's in his 20s, knows he's not going to be able to make a living off what he made on the football pitch because he wasn't good enough, and thinking of alternatives. And I think in some countries, they're like, all right, I'll go and buy a pub or I'll invest in a nightclub. But Klopp was so methodical, was so committed, and that's really what strikes me.
Yes, but there's also something I learned from talking to Pete Kravitz, his number three, who knew him at the time and then became an analyst and is still with him as the chief scout and opposition analyst. And he said that kind of willingness to win and sort of the ability to squeeze every last ounce out of yourself in terms of performance, even though he was a very limited footballer, comes not from that kind of sporting mentality that we often witness with, you know, big sports personalities. They just can't stand losing, etc. With him, it was more an existentialist fear of not being able to support his family. He was making a few thousand marks at the time, playing for Mainz in front of 3,000 people. They would get fairly lavish bonuses for winning. But in the words of Guido Schäfer, one of his teammates, the problem was we never won. And they were fighting not just against relegation, but actually for survival. Because the first thing that Mainz would have done in the third division is to sack all these guys who were on these ridiculously huge contracts by their own standards of 3,000 or 5,000 marks a month, which is before tax and really nothing. So he worked in a pub in his spare time. He worked, he was a sports science student. He did an internship at a TV company. And for him, I think fear, real fear was a real driving factor. And I think it only changed into something more pleasant and enjoyable and more sort of infused with passion and then the real sporting side of it once he became a manager. And, of course, had a similar battle to fight initially, but then very quickly things turned and then Mainz suddenly became from this joke team into a team that was regularly fighting for promotion and then achieved the miracle by their own standards of actually getting up and staying up.
He also spent some time in between, I think it's in between Mainz and Dortmund, on television as a pundit. I'm always kind of curious about that because he was actually very good at that. And how much of a role did that play in him getting the Dortmund gig?
That played a huge role. It played a huge role for a number of things. First of all, I think it played a huge role on the way German football was thought about and seen and talked about, because he pointed out things that were much more tangible
and didn't sort of go into this pop psychology stuff that most pundits at the time were saying, oh, they don't want it enough, they're arrogant, they're this, they're that, but actually saying, you know what, the right back's completely in the wrong position. Here's the evidence. I show it to you.
Is that, sorry, can I just jump in? Is that a little bit like what we've seen here, Neville and Carragher on Monday night?
10 years later, yeah, absolutely.
Whereas the lumps before was like, pigs, power, motivation.
Well, what Klopp did was remarkable, because not only was he able to explain football sort of in layman's terms to everybody and quite visually, which was very powerful, but also he used a language that wasn't patronizing to people. He talked to somebody the way he would talk to somebody in a pub who might not understand football that well. And don't forget, this is different when you do Confed Cup or World Cup. You have these casual viewers. You have 60 million people watching. Half of them might have never seen a football game before or just watching because it's on. And he still somehow managed to connect with them.
So you could connect both with the stay-at-home mum who just checks in once a year and with the stathead and
but
hardcore
with
guy.
The force of his personality. And then Dortmund, when they made the decision, it's unthinkable now, but he was, after getting relegated again with Mainz and failing to get promoted, he was a second division coach when they appointed him. But he did it.
It's like Watford with Marco Silva. Yeah. History repeating itself.
Yeah, but Watford are not Dortmund. And they could do it because he had such a presence and was such a kind of personality that people responded to him, even though he was, some people could have described him as a guy, you know, who had failed, who'd been relegated, and maybe he's a busted flush or one-trick pony or whatever. But he still had that huge charisma and that credit in the bank from people seeing this guy can really explain football. And we've seen what he's done with Mainz before, for him to appoint it. And they actually put him on advertising banners when they sold their season tickets. He was, their story that they sold to people was, Jurgen Klopp is our coach. We will play interesting football. Come buy a season ticket. They had a problem at the time selling enough season tickets.
The whole time he was at Dortmund, what struck me though was, man, these guys, like, they buy and sell players really, really well. And, you know, you look at like Lewandowski and Piszczek and Kagawa and whatever. So many examples. And I thought, wow, he must get along really well with that Michael Zork guy. Or Michael Zork, even though he sounds like an alien, he's actually like really good at what he does. And one of my concerns when I went to Liverpool is you go from Michael Zork to Michael Edwards and other people who, I honestly, all I know about these people, the people who buy and sell guys at Liverpool, is what I learned from Liverpool fan sites and Tony Evans. Because unlike in other countries, these people never speak to the media. They're faceless people. They even gave them sort of this amorphous title, the committee, right? And you tell me about how Klopp sees these people and how they see him. Because when I have the opportunity to sit down with him, he's always like, yeah, well, we'll always make the decisions together. But in the end, it's my responsibility, and that's how it is. I can't say it was his fault. And I kind of thought, that's a pretty grown-up stance for a manager to take. Is this really what he's like?
I can't tell you what really happens behind the scene. If he's really happy that missing out on Virgil van Dijk, allegedly the technical staff told him, sorry, there's absolutely no one else. It's van Dijk or no one, because our centre-backs are so good, we can't think of anyone else, sorry. It's a message that didn't go down well with the fans and with the public, because it's easy to ridicule, but I think it was directed to his own players, and it is something he does quite often, just to back them up, to say in public and privately, I still believe in you, it's not about, you know, I need all these other players because you're terrible. And I think he was towing the company line by not putting the blame for this, what was clearly a fiasco in the transfer market, at the feet of those people who didn't quite make the deal happen. Whether there was any alternative B option or not, I don't know, but I've been told that he relied on the information given to him by the people who do that for a living, and they identified him as the candidate, and they fought until the end still that they could make it happen, and when it didn't, that was it. I'm sure he was not happy about it. I'm sure he did not think, okay, great, but I think he conveyed a message that he felt was necessary for in-house rather than protecting himself, making these excuses, playing the political game that other managers would have played at that point. Talking to players, talking to former managers, to sporting directors, they very rarely felt, I think, that he was telling them something different to what he was saying in public. I think he is a guy that doesn't really throw people under the bus and doesn't want to be political, whether it's with his players or with his superiors. I think that's part of this longevity. If you stay 7 years at a club and then you do it again, you do it because you don't play these games. Because eventually, after playing these games usually kind of run out of angles and then you've got not a leg to stand on. With him, it's different.
As I understand football, it made no sense for Liverpool not to sell Philippe Coutinho at those numbers. And again, there's many different versions where there's a 120, 140, 150. But knowing that Naby Keita was coming, knowing that Salah was there, knowing you can only play with 11 men in one go, guy doesn't want to be there, why give yourself the headache? Other people say I'm an idiot for saying that. I got the impression from Klopp, from even what he said the Coutinho thing was out of his hands. He says if he stays, great. If he goes, great.
I wouldn't put it that way, because he is still the guy that decides everything. FSG are in kind of in awe of him. And if he says tomorrow that I want all toilet seats to be red, because white is not a positive colour, they make them red. But I think with this, in this particular case, I think he was just very agnostic. He did not care enough.
How can you be agnostic on your
because best he
player?
Saw yeah. Because he saw, first of all, I think he saw all the reasons that you saw. He's been in football in the same position enough to see that it doesn't always go the way of Lewandowski, who stayed 1.5 years, extra years, or even two, and kept performing. It can also go the other way when people are denied a big move and basically they're useless because they stop performing. I think he knows this. He's seen it often enough, even at places like Mainz, you know, where big players suddenly wanted to move to Frankfurt because it was their dream to play for Frankfurt rather than Mainz and caused a big fuss for months and months. And then stopped scoring goals. But he also saw FSG's point of view, which was very political. I think they did not want to be seen as, again, selling their best players. They wanted to make a statement that those days are over. And he was quite happy to go along with. He sees himself as a coach. And I think that's something that, from an English point of view, many people don't get their head around easily. And this goes back to your talk question. He doesn't really, I think so much in terms of constructing a squad and value. And, you know, do I have to sell him for 150 or do I need to sell him only for 100? I mean, I don't think these are really questions that he concerns himself with. He wants to have a good squad. He wants to have players who are motivated, who play well, that he feels will perform for him. And as long as that there's a chance of that happening, he wants to work with his player. And I think that's for him really is the bottom line. Super interesting thing I found talking to Hummels when he said, you know, it basically took him 3 years to get it right at Dortmund. And before that, it was kind of madness because they were playing this pressing game that didn't quite work out and they conceded loads of goals. They finished sixth and fifth. And then Hummels and Subotic comes in and says, actually, it was a joy to play because the guys in front were putting so much pressure on the opposition that they never really had time to play proper ball. So all you had to do as a defender is just look and you wait. They're under so much pressure, they cannot play a really good ball. You just have to be in the right position. And it was a joy for you to defend. And clearly Liverpool are not quite there yet. And clearly Liverpool have also individual problems. I think it's fair to say that the goalkeeper doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. And that's a problem that they haven't quite solved yet. And yes, they could have done with Virgil van Dijk. So I wouldn't absolve Klopp from any blame, but I don't see that it's necessarily a black and white thing. Oh, there's this guy who plays this wonderful football but can't defend. I think that's what they said about Pep Guardiola last year.
The book is Bring the Noise, Jurgen Klopp's unauthorized biography by Ralf Honigstein. It's out there now. Ralf, Guillaume Balague did this. He sort of had a haiku competition where you could win a signed copy of the book. You don't have to do this, but I would suggest that...
My tastes are more lowbrow than that.
Yeah, I've noticed that. But maybe... if people want to send in a Klopp haiku, will you choose the best one?
I'd be delighted
on Twitter and then send them a signed copy.
Yes, of course.
So please send your Klopp haikus to @Honigstein,
yeah.
And you can CC @Marcotti while you're at it, and he will send a signed copy of the book to the top 175 entrants. No, just kidding.
Good luck.
To the top few entrants. Raf, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to the quick hits. And Ollie, one for you. Chelsea peg back Liverpool at Anfield thanks to a late William Cross, I think we can call it, rather than a shot. This was the most hyped game of the weekend. So why did Fabregas, Firmino and Mane all start on the bench, Ollie?
Well, because they played in the Champions League in midweek, and although Liverpool's game was Tuesday rather than Wednesday, Mane and Firmino were felt to be exhausted by it. They played a lot of games recently, and Klopp clearly felt that the best hope of winning the game was to leave them on the bench and bring them on later on if they were chasing a win. As Chelsea, when they'd gone to Baku and got back early hours of Thursday or 5 a.m. on Thursday or something like that. And I think it's understandable, really, that players were not felt to be in the condition, the peak condition needed to play a game like that, which was a disappointment as a spectator. You know, you'd hope that the best players were there, and I think the quality in both attacks was a bit diminished by that. But you know, needs must, really, and it ended up looking like both managers were sort of grudgingly content with what they got in these circumstances.
Manchester United are hanging on to City's coattails, or, well, barely hanging, I think, but they edge out Brighton 1-0 at Old Trafford. And Ashley Young plays a starring role again. Bill, is he now United's first-choice left-back? And if so, could he even go to the World Cup with England in that position?
I think, yes, Mourinho does see him as United's first-choice left-back. He certainly has a chance of going to the World Cup. On the face of it, England have two top-class left-backs in Luke Shaw and Danny Rose, but Luke Shaw is being ignored by Jose Mourinho at Manchester United, so he's not getting any sort of practice, so at the moment the World Cup looks impossible. Danny Rose seems to have some sort of issue with Pochettino at Tottenham. He's coming back very slowly from his long-term injury, so maybe a vacancy is opening up at left-back, and certainly Young has extra use in the... he's very versatile. He can play on the right and he can play in midfield as well, so certainly he must have a chance.
West Brom take a priceless point from Wembley as they draw with Spurs, and they might even have had all three. Gary Megson's done that bit, but Alan Pardew is odds on to become the next Baggies manager. Would he be your choice, Ollie?
He would certainly be a choice. I think the main criticism of Pardew over the years has been, well, you know, he's all very well for 6, 12, 18 months, but things always seem to sort of nosedive after that. And I think in West Brom's position, where they're struggling at the bottom end of the Premier League, I think they would go for that. I think the idea of a 6 month, 12 month, 18 month bounce to take into the end of next season, probably as a Premier League team, would more than fulfil their immediate requirements. There would also be, I think, a slightly more expansive approach than they saw under Pulis, so I can see the appeal of that, certainly.
Bill, for the third meeting in a row, Arsenal score a last-minute winner against Burnley. This time, Alexis Sanchez scores from the penalty spot and Sean Dyche is raging. And we mean raging after James Tarkowski is judged to have pushed Aaron Ramsey. Did Dyche have a case?
Well, it wasn't clear-cut. I think Tarkowski definitely pushed Ramsey. Was it strong enough? I think it probably was. So I think it should have been a penalty. Having said that, Ramsey certainly threw himself to the floor. Interesting comparison with Nias of Everton, who's been booked for diving. The problem with Nias was not that he dived and is therefore a cheat, because almost every player does that. His problem was misinterpreting the amount of contact from Scott Dan and thinking that it was going to be enough contact for the referee to give a penalty. As it turned out, it wasn't enough, so therefore he got banned. Players dive and therefore cheat, and they have to judge correctly that there's enough contact, and Ramsey got it right.
Yeah, well, it's one of those ones for me. If you can understand why the ref's given it, then you should crack on with it until we have the VAR, and that's a whole different debate. But anyway, Ollie, speaking of late drama, Crystal Palace secure just their second win of the season thanks to Sacco's stoppage time goal against Stoke. They lost their first seven games, but they're now 3 points from safety. Would this be the greatest Premier League escape, and will Roy Hodgson be knighted at the end of the season?
I don't think it would even be Roy Hodgson's greatest Premier League escape. I mean, you go back to that one at Fulham, where it seemed that they were completely doomed. You go back to one at Leicester under Nigel Pearson, where they seemed completely doomed with 10 games remaining. The good thing about Hodgson taking over in this situation was that there was so much time to get things right. He didn't hit the ground running, but you've seen the improvement. They look more solid, have more belief, and the fact that they're scoring a last-minute winner in a game like that says something for their spirit, and it's all encouraging. They can stay up. I think there are probably six teams at the moment, probably six teams with fairly big reputations that would be battling to avoid relegation. I think it looks like a real scrap, and I think it will go down a very long way.
Can't get enough of Roy Hodgson's goal celebration, surely. The little dancey jig, sort of punch in the air. Sadly, we didn't see that as much as we would have liked to against Iceland. But anyway, Mark Silver's stock continues to rise as Watford batter Newcastle 3-0 at St James's Park. Bill, we've raved about Silver enough on this podcast, so let's talk about the team. Would you like to single out any Watford player for special praise?
Yeah, I mean, there's a structure that Marco Silva has created. And
now you say you're talking about Silva again.
Yeah,
you see,
sorry. Let me go straight to, let's say, Christian Cabasele, the centre-back. They've had, Watford have had Kabul, Cathcart, Prodl all injured this season. So Cabasele has been the senior centre-back, and he's just warmed to the task, played really well. He was the centre of three centre-backs to start with on Saturday. He moved to the left when there was a substitution, so he did well in both. He marked well, he got a couple of good blocks in, did a couple of nice long balls in the build-up to two of the goals. He's done really well. Whether he gets into Belgium's team at the World Cup with Alderweireld and Vertonghen and Vermaelen ahead of him, it's unlikely, but he should be in the squad at least, and he's certainly having a good time at Watford. Dicko, one for you. It's the World Cup draw on Friday. Should we even care, given how England have such a tendency to let us down?
Oh, quick hit. This could be a whole book, as our colleague Henry Winter has written. Well, it's going to be balls out of the bag, and England are in the second pot, which is sort of good news, which means they can't get Spain, who are also in the second pot with them, but does mean they can get Brazil or Germany. And we get down about England, but the fact is that there'll only be one thing that gets 20 million odd people watching TV altogether at the same time in 2018, and that would be a big England World Cup game. So let's look forward with, well, not complete despair for now.
Hi there, I'm Paddy Von Baer, and I'm here with your weekly update from The Sweeper, the Times' fantasy football service. You can, of course, sign up for free at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball, and you'll have an email dropping in your inbox every Friday full of tips. It was a slightly strange game week, this one. No one scored more than Marvin Ziegler's 14. The Watford defender, an unlikely hero. Raheem Sterling shone while Leroy Sané was quiet. Charlie Austin finally started a game and scored twice for Southampton. But early warning, we'd steer clear of their players for now. Southampton's schedule gets a little bit tricky now, so don't be fooled by that false dawn. Elsewhere, Pascal Gross managed 3 bonus points, despite Brighton losing to Man United, if you needed further evidence of his fantasy potential. Eden Hazard and Mo Salah were once again on fire as Chelsea and Liverpool drew 1-1. And a nice little boost again for our ongoing love affair with Ruben Loftus-Cheek. He scored for Crystal Palace and continues to be a lovely bargain. In terms of our weekly tips, there were some hits and some misses. Will Hughes was the highlight. The Watford midfielder scored for a second week in a row for 8 points. He's only 4.6 million, so that looks like a nice bargain midfielder to side with. Eden Hazard set up a goal for Chelsea in their draw with Liverpool, picked up 8 points, and Harry Kane was back to goal-scoring form with 8 points as well. There were some frustrations elsewhere where Ben Mee was denied a late clean sheet. Wilfred Zaha could have scored a couple. Paul Pogba was denied on the line, and Leroy Sané hit the bar with an excellent free kick for Man City. Don't be fooled by his blank against Huddersfield. There are more points coming from him. And we're back into things immediately as there's Premier League action midweek, a full schedule of fixtures Tuesday and Wednesday, which means good news for Sweeper subscribers. There'll be a bonus email landing in your inbox on Tuesday morning. It does mean there's no time for a full weekend roundup on the Timesport website, but who needs that when there's more hints and tips landing in your inbox as of first thing Tuesday morning? You can sign up for free at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball.
That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Bill Edgar and Oliver Kay. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Just search The Times online, and this season you can access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League and the FA Cup. You will be absolutely delighted and possibly relieved to hear that Gab Marcotti returns next week, when he will be leading discussion on the latest chapter in the Wenger-Mourinho, well, it says rivalry here, I think pretty nasty feud at various stages. But yes, it's Arsenal-Man United, and tune in next week. Thanks very much for joining us.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.